practically 100% of college admissions from 1964 to 1982. Targeted minority recruitment? Selective service. Reverse discrimination? Don't trust anyone over 30. UC Berkeley political activist Jack Weinberg coined the phrase in 1964. He turned 30 in 1970, and baby boomers have been teasing him ever since. Minority outreach. All those ads for Depends and Levitra on network television. And minority set-asides. Social Security and Medicare. About 35% of the federal budget now goes to those two minority entitlement programs. It's estimated that by 2030, when the last of our generation is struggling with how to get the Depends on after the Levitra's been taken, boomer Americans will be raking in Social Security and Medicare benefits, costing half of all the money spent in Washington. We're riding down the highway of life in a welfare Cadillac, with the right turn indicator blinking for miles and miles. Tax rates will go through the roof, which should keep those Generation X slackers busy and maybe take their minds off Kurt Cobain dying. Besides, our families had money. True, they didn't have much money. In 1947, median family income was $3,031. Median, meaning that this was the income for that peculiar family able to look down upon the paltry earnings of exactly one half of the nation, while regarding with envious resentment the other one half who were rolling in it. $3,000 and change is about $31,700 in 2013 dollars. That's only $4,130 a year more than the 2013 poverty threshold for a family of five. In 1947, to be middle income was a blessing of middling proportions. It was nonetheless a blessing. The greatest generation consecrated itself to raising the country's median income, and they would continue with their devotions. By 1964, median household income had reached nearly $49,700 in 2013 dollars, in time to sanctify the baby boom with college educations. Incidentally, don't try this today. Sending an out-of-state kid to UC Berkeley, for example, costs $38,000 a year in tuition and fees. The growth of prosperity for middle-income Americans is oddly difficult to measure. Like many things government didn't used to be, it didn't used to be a statistical busybody. The Census Bureau has no figures for median household income before 1947. The economist, Emmanuel Saez, a professor at Berkeley, which institution seems to keep intruding itself into baby boom discussion, has spent much of the past decade trying to determine average income in the United States over the previous century. Of course, income is not the same as household income, especially in a two-income household. And an average is a mean, and a mean is not a median. I told you we should have paid attention in econ. Averages are blurry statistics with their ink smeared by champagne spills at the top and damp seeping into empty refrigerator cartons where people are living at the bottom. Dr. Size calculates that in the years when the greatest generation was growing up, 1913 to 1932, average annual income ranged between about $12,000 at its lowest and $17,000 at its highest, 2013 dollars. In the years when the greatest generation had the baby boom at home and underfoot, 1946 to 1964, average annual income ranged between about $27,000 and about $45,000, 2013 dollars. But it's not just the numbers we don't grasp that matter. It's the zigzags on the graph we don't understand that are important, too. For the eldest baby boom children, there weren't any zigzags. From 1946 to 1964, average income climbed the social ladder, with only the merest slips from shabby genteel to shabby chic. The greatest generation had a different childhood. From 1913 to 1932, average income went up, down, way down, and the best year and the worst year were only a couple of years apart. This is why our parents never had any use for shabby, or much understanding of chic. The economy is a kind of confidence game. Maybe what gave the baby boom its confident air is better gauged by gross domestic product per capita, all the money the people in a country make divided by all the people. It tells us nothing about our individual economic circumstance, what we eat, but it tells us a lot about our economic atmosphere, what we breathe. Adjusted for inflation, per capita GDP for the years 1913 through 1932 averages approximately $8,500. This is the world of our parents. Adjusted for inflation, per capita GDP for the years 1946 through 1964 averages approximately $18,500. This is the world of us. Blood is thicker than water, but gravy is thicker than both. The difference between the manners, mores, behavior, and attitudes of the greatest generation and the baby boom is $10,000. However, we can do anything leaves us with a lot of choices. An extravagance of choice doesn't necessarily lead to making choices that are extravagantly good. And when we can do anything, the things start to come apart from the doing. Success gets separated from effort. Fame gets separated from merit. Dad gets separated from Mom. Existence has been more confusing for the baby boom than it was for the greatest generation. Not that we mind. It makes life interesting. We can do confusion. Jim Fisk was a legacy at Tapakega Brew, or I Felt a Thigh, or some fraternity, and he considered himself obliged to go to a rush party. His dad had said, "They're a swell bunch of guys in that greatest generation between us fellows way," just short of a wink and a nod, indicating there was a bottle of old granddad somewhere in the frat house, and maybe a dimly lit room where you could go with a date to neck. It was unlikely that, after 25 years, the swell bunch of guys were still hanging around. This wouldn't happen until later in the baby boom years, after Animal House was released, the drinking age was raised to 21, and fraternities became cool again. When Jim returned to the dorm that night, he said, "It's like they were practicing to be adults, all in sport coats and ties." Perhaps this was a strange objection from a generation that would don an astonishing array of outlandish apparel. But one thing we don't do is wear what we're supposed to wear. With the baby boom, clothing's function gets separated from clothing's form. We've conducted life as a costume party. It's been an important party, which we've needed to attend for serious reasons because we've turned fashions into statements. Army fatigues and old pea coats were a satire on militarism. Work shirts made an ironic comment about work. There's no need to repeat the message 1970s duds were sending. The huge shoulder pads on women in the 1980s were a declaration that women had the power and the prerogatives usually accorded to men, usually in the NFL. Today we wear something comfortable, whether we're mall walking or receiving a Nobel Prize, because who we really are is expressed by wearing something comfortable, and the King of Sweden should get comfortable with who we really are. Halloween, you'll notice, has become a holiday for grown-ups. So I take Jim Fisk's point from years ago. Dress as an adult? What a get-up! "If you become a pledge," Jim said, "you have to vacuum the carpet and write term papers for upperclassmen and stand on one leg while reciting the Greek alphabet, and they paddle you. After that, they're supposed to be your best friends for life. I'm confused about the connection between this and fun. And I was confused about the connection between actions and consequences in general. Or I was, once most of the co-eds had prescriptions for the pill. I was also confused about why my literature professor couldn't see the connection between great poets like Bob Dylan and T.S. Eliot. In the room the women come and go talking of Michelangelo, something is happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? The literary parallel seemed clear to me. Not that I had any ears for clarity. That was Robert Frost, greeting card stuff, of no interest whatsoever in the happy confusion of a 1960s dorm room bull session. Although Frost had an effect on the 1960s, the road not taken. I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Then everybody took the road less traveled by, and that made the 1960s. Maybe my anthropology class will explain the significance of initiation ceremonies and fraternities and sport coats, Jim said. The other difference between the baby boom and the greatest generation is college. Not that none of them went, and all of us did. By 1950, when the GI Bill had done its best work, about 14% of Americans had some college experience. But by the time Animal House came out in 1978, more than 30% of Americans had been at or near a toga party. Anyone who has dealt with an audience knows there's a tipping point when about a third of the crowd gets a joke. Example given, in the Where Are They Now clips at the end of Animal House, there's a picture of U.S. Senator Blutarsky. And that reminds me of Margaret Mead coming to campus. I went to see her with Jim. She wore a skirt and sat in an armchair on stage. She had big, wide, really enormous knees that looked like Bluto when he was getting ready to impersonate a zit. There was a vogue for leading thinkers coming to campus, and for thinking that their thoughts led somewhere, and for baby boomers being smitten with them. Margaret Mead's knees were a distraction, but her presence was nonetheless intensely important. Self-consciousness is baby boom's salient trait. The crush is our signal emotion, and intense is our default mode. Marshall McLuhan came to campus. The 1960s was an era of large thoughts, and yet, amazingly, each of those thoughts could fit on a T-shirt. The medium is the message. Buckminster Fuller came to campus, too. His nickname among architects was Fuckminster Bullshit. A couple of years later, Timothy Leary was there. I was deeply impressed by his line of reasoning that was so convoluted even he couldn't follow it. Yes, I was stoned, but I walked away in awe that someone that old, he was in his 40s, could still talk crazy talk. It gave me hope for the future. My hope for the future has not been disappointed in this one respect. Jim Fisk and I began hanging around at one of those old, large, and run-down houses rented to a constantly shuffled pack of students by landlords who have made a deal with the devil, the fire insurance company and the county health department. Such houses in college towns were given names, perhaps because so much of college education has to do with naming things. Ontogeny, phylogeny, tapakega brew. This house was called Big Green, after the color it had once been painted. Here in the prescribed disorder was the accustomed misbehavior and the requisite mayhem with the obligatory colorful characters. Mostly it involved beer, but drugs were beginning to make an appearance, or rather a smell. Now and then some of the tenants of the house would disappear mysteriously into the basement. A strong odor came up the stairs. The first time I visited, I ran to the cellar door and yelled, "I think something's on fire down there." High, squeaky, hold-your-breath voices from below, "Everything's fine." Jumbo was the first communist I'd ever met. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Jumbo needed beer. Uncle Mike was a physics grad student who spent a lot of time in the basement and a lot of the rest of the time in his room using plexiglass, string, and felt-tipped markers to make models of four-dimensional cubes. Uncle Mike also liked handguns, and no matter what had gone on Saturday night, he got up on Sunday morning, put on a suit, and went to Mass. Dirty Eddie was the first hippie I'd ever met, and the first person I'd ever heard say, "Oh, wow." "It might rain." "Oh, wow." Dirty Eddie was letting all his fingernails grow, to see if he could. Jack Hubert had been drafted and sent to Vietnam. He told us about the horrors of war. "The Vietnamese clap is the worst clap in the world. There are claw marks on the walls over all the urinals in Saigon from guys who got the Vietnamese clap." Jack used his GI student benefits to buy a Norton Commando 750, which was supposed to be the fastest motorcycle made. The Norton was so aggressive-looking that it seemed like it could hurt you standing still. And with beer and faulty kickstand placement, it did just that to Jack. There were parties at Big Green on Friday night and Saturday night, and on Sunday night, and Tuesday night and Thursday night, because smart people signed up for classes that met only on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and on Monday night and Wednesday night, because smart people signed up for classes that met afternoon. Sometimes the local bar band would bring its guitars and amplifiers, set up in the middle of the dining room, and perform "Tom Dooley" by the Kingston Trio, "Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying" by Jerry and the Pacemakers, and "Paperback Writer" by the Beatles, because these can be played with two chords. Sometimes someone would suggest a Mazzola party, where everybody got naked in a heap on the floor and poured cooking oil all over themselves. But that much Mazzola would cost a lot, and the floor was covered with cigarette butts and pop tops. The next day, everyone who was living in the house or who was still there after the party swept the floor. Under the front rooms of Big Green was a crawl space, 25 feet by 12 feet and 4 feet deep. A trap door opened into it. All the beer cans went down there. By June, it was full. I calculate that during the 1965-66 school year, we had 1,200 cubic feet of fun. Our generation is identified with drugs, and even now the baby boom accords great significance, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, to drugs. But we never gave up on beer. We know what's good for us. Even when we were in our most hallucinogenic phase, we drank beer. Expanding your mind is like putting an addition on your house. You have to dig this stupid foundation first. And yet, none of us has ever claimed that we've acquired happiness or peace of mind or wisdom or self-knowledge through beer. Nobody reads Aldous Huxley's The Six-Pack of Perception. Are we being deliberately dishonest with ourselves? There's that baby boom thesis that postulates we can do anything. And on the subject of this thesis, beer teaches important lessons the next day. Late one night, we ran out of beer. Jack Hubert said he knew a place in the county part of town where they sold moonshine. He returned with four mason jars. We drank them. I vomited, and I woke up blind. All I could see was blank, white nothingness. I squinted. I blinked. Everything was white. There was a cold ring of pain around the top of my skull. "I drank moonshine and I'm blind." I had passed out with my head upside down in the toilet. "What is love? 'Tis not hereafter, Present mirth hath present laughter. What's to come is still unsure. In delay there lies no plenty. Then come, kiss me, sweet and twenty. Youth's a stuff will not endure. William Shakespeare, Twelfth Night. 12. Era of Good Feelings. If the 60s were the wild times we insist they were, we should have better stories. I blame it on drugs. When you drink beer, a lot of things happen in the world. When you take drugs, a lot of things happen in your head. Although sometimes the world and your head get mixed together. Once, when I had taken LSD, I became convinced that Big Green's stairwell was the inside of an evil giant eel. If I went upstairs, I'd be chewed by giant eel teeth. If I went downstairs, I'd be eel shit. You spend a lot of your wild times just sitting there when you take drugs. Dirty Eddie took drugs all the time. Not that he was inert. Sometimes he was busily to and fro in the world, in a stoned way. He found a discarded floor model console radio and somehow wrestled it back to Big Green and upstairs to his room. Plugged in, the radio received no broadcasts, but its large, round dial lit up and its vacuum tubes produced a low hum. The hum was, said Eddie, Om, the cosmic sound of God. Eddie was a Hindu at the moment. He painted his room in saffron and red horizontal stripes. Saffron, he said to anyone who would listen, is the Vedic symbol of asceticism, and red is the Vedic symbol of sensuality. These wouldn't seem to go together, and they didn't, because the two cans of paint that Eddie found on the discount table at the hardware store were icky yellow and dark pink. Eddie painted the stripes freehand, beginning with the floorboards and going around the room, over the woodwork, doors, light fixtures, window frames, window glass, curtains, and shades as high as he could reach, which left an additional stripe of flowered wallpaper visible beneath the crown moldings. The ultraviolet black light effects, the day-glow posters and the lava lamps that people claim to remember from the 1960s would have been, comparatively, in restrained good taste. Eddie also found, or purloined, a dozen metal folding chairs and arranged these facing the radio in what he called the Ohm Theater. He sat in the front row, cross-legged on one of the chairs, hands templed at his sternum, humming along with the Philco. Nobody joined him. Dirty Eddie took to spending so much time in the Ohm Theater that the rest of us at Big Green forgot he was there. Uncle Mike's room was next to Dirty Eddie's. Uncle Mike, so called for his avuncular way when urging others to use intoxicants and firearms, took drugs, too, but he drank beer more often, especially when something was wrong with the world, such as the Kaluza-Klein theory of five-dimensional cubes, President Johnson's proposed Gun Control Act, Vatican II, or a girl. One day something was very wrong with the world. Uncle Mike returned from a long evening at the final exam, locked himself in his room, and expressed his Weltschmerz, or Weltschlitz, as it were, by firing a pistol into a wall about 50 times. My girlfriend and I were downstairs and didn't pay much attention. It was a small-caliber pistol, and Uncle Mike had expressed himself before. We heard Uncle Mike unlock his door and walk, rather heavily, down the hallway toward the bathroom. Then there was a pause, followed by screaming. We ran upstairs. Dirty Eddie was lying on the pink and yellow floor in a tangle of chair legs.
I killed him! I killed him! I killed him! Screamed Uncle Mike. I'm dead! I'm dead! I'm dead! Screamed Dirty Eddie. I shot through the wall and the bullets hit him! Screamed Uncle Mike. He shot through the wall and the bullets hit me! Screamed Dirty Eddie.
My girlfriend turned on the ceiling light. Eddie hadn't been able to get to it with his paintbrush. There didn't seem to be any blood on Dirty Eddie, although, what with the paint splatters all over his clothes, it was hard to tell. I looked at the wall in Eddie's room. There were no bullet holes. I looked at the wall in Mike's room. There were plenty of bullet holes. A weeping Uncle Mike was kneeling over a prostrate Dirty Eddie.
I killed him! I'm dead! I killed him! I'm dead!
Uncle Mike, I said, the wall in Eddie's room doesn't have any bullet holes in it. Of course it doesn't, my girlfriend said. Uncle Mike's closet is in between. When Uncle Mike went to Mass on Sunday, he could wiggle his fingers through the punctures in his suit coat pockets. Of course, this girlfriend at Big Green, Diane, was not the same girlfriend as the girlfriend in high school, Karen. We understand ourselves as an existential generation, creatures of here and now. Karen had an existential problem. She wasn't here now. Not that I didn't still love Karen, in the 60s sense of love, meaning fuck. Once the baby boom had decided war was wrong, and prejudice, poverty, and injustice should be eliminated and had gone to college, we began to understand ourselves as a noble generation. We had a right, droit du seigneur, to have sex, and noblesse oblige, an obligation to. Rights must be exercised in order to be preserved. We got a lot of exercise. Diane was everything I desired. She laughed at my stories about how Al Barz had commandeered the West Side High PA system. When Leo Luhan came for a visit from Big State, she didn't make fun of him for falling down the trapdoor into the crawl space because he was wearing sunglasses indoors. She had, evidence indicated, fantasized about having sex with someone less tall and handsome than the boys on the old-school cheer patio, in every imaginable position. She knew a dozen. If the sculptures she produced in our class were anything to go by, she may have harbored a secret fondness for customizing plastic model cars. Diane is my rod and my staff. We've been through the shadowed valleys, green pastures, and still waters. And the grandchildren are adorable. On another planet, in some different dimension, out along one of those infinite tangents of choice that spun away in every direction from the perfect circle of the baby boom self. I blame it on drugs. I don't blame drugs for what I did to Diane. I blame drugs for the other planet, the different dimension, and all the tangents the baby boom went off on. And our spacey inclinations may explain why the baby boom wasn't as impressed with the 1969 moon landing as we should have been. Moon? We thought. Everyone's gone to the moon. We weren't the first generation to fly around the room under the influence of pixie dust, act like fools with girls who called themselves Tinkerbell and Tiger Lily, battle an imagined villain such as Hook, be he captain of pirate ship, industry, police force, or army, and string Wendy along for years while she yearned for a home and children of her own. But we were the generation that did it best. Either we blame it on drugs or we blame it on ourselves, and let's not be silly. For the middle class, middle America, middlingly hip baby boom, drugs arrived at the end of 1966. On Christmas break, Jim Fisk, Tim Minsky, Anna Klein, Leo Luhan, and Al Bartz were in the finished basement at my house. We had a wooden matchbox completely full of pot. Joe Brody, as resident mischief maker, rightly should have been the one who scored. or Tim Minsky, home from Whitted, Yale, but it was pre-med Al Bartz. Organic chem grad student, he said knowingly. Joe, however, figured out how to use the rolling papers. Anna said, all of existence is a dance. A pardon, a parole, said Joe. A lesson in organic chemistry, said Al. A proof of Fermat's theorem, said Tim. And a baby boom mathematician would prove it, though not Tim Minsky. A vindication of the rights of man, said Jim. Oh, wow, said Leo. I said, John Milton smoked pot, and got out my Norton Anthology of English Literature to prove it. And joy shall overtake us as a flood, when everything that is sincerely good and perfectly divine, with truth and peace and love shall ever shine. Then all this earthy grossness quit, attired with stars we shall forever sit, triumphing over death and chance and thee, O time. We'd lost track of time. My mother came back from her bridge game, ran to the cellar door and yelled, I think something's on fire down there. Did drugs give the baby boom its taste for big ideas? More than enough big ideas were going around already in the 60s. Of the many big ideas I had on drugs, I can remember one. I had a sudden insight that there was a whole world outside me and a whole world inside me, and the outer world was no larger or more important than the inner world. But the inner world hadn't been explored, and society was telling me I could sail off the edge of it. So I took the Nina, the Pinta, the Santa Maria, and some more LSD. I contain multitudes. Walt Whitman probably did take drugs, judging by the way his poetry scans. The word epiphany and the word fantasy have the same root in the Greek phainein, to show. Psychedelic drugs put on quite a show. Over the years, I've asked old friends what effect drug-taking had on the baby boom. When he got his first job selling boats, Billy Stumpf said, it's a great sales tool. I mean, for understanding the way customers think. I mean, you really don't know how stupid people are if you haven't taken drugs. Back when we were still taking a lot of drugs, besides Lipitor, Jumbo said, drugs are the opiate of the masses, and added, I'm a mass movement kind of guy. Uncle Mike, who's been on the wagon since 1982, said, it was just part of the fun. We were issued a lifetime supply of fun in the 60s, although I went through mine pretty quick. Tim Minsky said, drugs taught a generation of Americans the metric system. And who indeed knew what a kilo or a gram was before pot and coke began arriving in those quantities? Jim Fisk said, drugs helped me with parenting by showing me how to lie to my children. I used to tell little lies. Oh, that old picture of Daddy with his hair all over the place? I was in a band. We played at folk masses. Then the kids got old enough to start asking about drugs. I realized I had to go big or go bust. I never took drugs. We thought drugs were really bad when I was at college. Drugs make people do embarrassing things, and then the Rush Committee won't let you pledge Tap a Keg of Brew even though you're a legacy through Grandpa. Jim is a writer. Jim, I said, you're a writer. You've written about taking drugs. Fortunately, he said, the only people you can count on to never read anything you've written are your children. I'm counting on it myself. Joe Brody said, drugs are a one-man birthday party. You don't get any presents you don't bring. Al Bartz said drugs were a lesson in organic chemistry. The brain is an organic chemistry factory. Baby boomers with psychiatric problems know something's wrong with their brain chemistry. When I prescribe drugs for depression, anxiety, obsessive-compulsive disorder, or whatever, all my patients born before 1946 ask when they can get off drugs. All my patients born after 1946 ask when they can get more. Leo Luhan said, "Oh, wow." And Anna Klein said she couldn't make up her mind about the effect of drug taking on the baby boom. She wasn't sure whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, although drugs had put several boyfriends and two husbands out of the picture, and she wasn't sure whether that was a good thing or a bad thing either. The sexual revolution was a bad thing. Imagine if what happened with sex and women in the 60s happened with golf and men in their 60s. The club is a wonderful place with great facilities and a fabulous course. You had always had a standing invitation to play there, but club membership was restricted. No matter how often you'd been to club events, and no matter how willingly you had helped out with buffets, suppers, table decorations, and cleaning up after the party, you couldn't join on your own. Suddenly, you're a member. But it turns out you're expected to mow the fairways and tend the greens yourself and do all the club's cooking and cleaning, too. You not only get to play, you have to play. You're required to be in every foursome. Well, let's not exaggerate, every twosome. And abortion isn't legal yet, so no mulligans. No cheap jokes about hole-in-one tournaments, either. We never thought of our 1960s sexual excursions as causing us to lose our bearings in our 1960s political movements or make detours in our 1960s spiritual journeys. We must have had quite a map, and not for nothing was the word trip overused in the 60s. Beginning our mystical jaunt, we carried very little luggage. The only religious idea that any of us seemed to remember from going through the motions and maintaining the forms at Sunday school was a phrase of the Apostle John's from a part of the New Testament that even Johnny McKay hadn't had to read, the First Epistle General of John, chapter 4, verse 8, God is love. Oddly, the Jewish kids seemed to remember it too, which says something about the well-intentioned homogeneity of 1950s American culture. Although, I don't know what it says, because not long after we learned God is love, we learned love in the 60s sense. "These things I command you, that ye fuck one another. Thou shalt fuck thy neighbor as thyself. Better is a dinner of herbs where a fuck is than a stalled ox back home with your parents. Greater love hath no woman than this, that a woman lay down with everybody. So faith, hope, and love abide, but the greatest of these is a blowjob. For God so fucked the world." We are a unitary generation, determined that the physical, the metaphysical, and the intellectual be brought together, not to say get all mixed up. We recognize no separation of minds, spirits, and bodies, especially bodies. Or we didn't, until baby boom feminists read the riot act to baby boom chauvinists during the divorce. After that, only one body occupied the physical house, and the bank account became metaphysical because the intellectual lawyer had to be paid. But 40-some years ago, the baby boom could be observed in its unadulterated, a pun on adultery is lurking in there, state, trying to get to all the places no one had ever been before, and hoping to get enlightened, stoned, and laid in all those places at the same time. "Dear Mom and Dad, I'm trying to find myself. I think I might be in San Francisco. Please send airfare." Of course, this is a sweeping generalization about the baby boom. More than enough sweeping generalizations are going around already in this book. A unitary generation we may have been. a unified generation. We weren't. Many baby boomers were almost normal. Sometimes, in moments of doubt, one wonders if there's really such a thing as a baby boom generation at all. For example, everything I have to say about the 60s baby boom is what, in deductive logic, is called fallacy of the undistributed middle term. To put it into a syllogism. Major proposition. In 1967, everyone between the age of 21 and the age of 3 was a member of the baby boom. Minor proposition, I was nuts. Conclusion, what a generation. Or, using inductive logic, I'm thinking about the 6 of us who grew up at the same end of the block. Billy and Bobby Stumpf, Johnny McKay, Steve Penske, Jerry Harris, and me. We were a pretty good statistical sample, being randomly acquainted in a random city in that random state, Ohio. We were a socioeconomic cross-section. We weren't, really. But in those days, everybody who wasn't considered normal was considered abnormal. Being black and poor and other things meant you were a statistical outlier. And, in fact, we were an economic cross-section of a kind. Suburbia had not begun its meritocratic sorting of educated elites from people who lift things. David Brooks wasn't born yet. Susie Inwood's dad was a postman. Mr. Biedermeier was assistant superintendent of schools. Mr. Stumpf sold, strangely or aptly, considering how he'd risked his life in World War II and Korea, life insurance. My dad sold cars. Mr. McKay owned a printing company. Mr. Penske was a telephone lineman. Mr. Harris managed the produce department at a grocery store. The 6 of us were all boys, which leaves out half of the baby boom. But that was the 60s for you. See Sexual Revolution above. Steve Penske died young. He accidentally drowned while fishing. Dying young was a very 60s thing to do. But while fishing? Johnny McKay stayed born again, and not because of cancer, jail, or a 12-step program, or those wet baptismal gowns, but because he believed what he'd been taught, which is never a sufficient excuse with our generation. Jerry Harris didn't go to West Side High. He went to Central Tech. He never attended college, and he learned a trade. Thus, there is no part for him to play in the 60s baby boom narrative. François Villon escaping the gallows to be an apprentice plumber? Bobby Stumpf volunteered for Vietnam, returned to our hometown and became a policeman. That leaves me and Billy Stumpf, who was selling boats the last I heard, and I've lost touch with Billy. But who wants logic? Being logical would have wrecked the 60s. The 60s were so creative. Being logical wrecks every form of creativity. Hamlet lets it slide. Lady Macbeth says, "Oh, listen to you, big thane of Cawdor. Enough already with the social climbing." Iago talks trash about Desdemona. TLC makes a reality TV show about it. Everybody gets paid a fortune. And Othello becomes a spokesperson for a national campaign against family violence. Anyway, sweeping generalizations about 1960s sexual excursions, political movements, and spiritual journeys are all right. It's not as if we got very far on most of our trips. We were thrown out of Big Green because the owner was, quite rightly, tearing the place down. Also, we hadn't paid the rent. Jumbo found us a farmhouse for $125 a month. The gorilla must move among the peasants as a fish swims in the sea, Jumbo said, quoting Chairman Mao. Not that Jumbo went outdoors much, and the peasants were Republican. Uncle Mike got a hold of some dynamite. In those days you could buy dynamite and fuses and blasting caps at the feed and grain store for blowing up stumps. We didn't have a stump, But Uncle Mike thought that just the blowing up part would be a trip. We were stoned. We'd been sitting on the front porch all afternoon smoking hashish until the world had slowed to a crawl. Uncle Mike seemed to take forever inserting the blasting cap into the stick of dynamite and the fuse into the blasting cap. Finally, he had the cap crimped and his Zippo ready, and he began to walk out into the hayfield the farmhouse had instead of a yard. He walked, and he walked, and he walked, and walked, and walked. At last, far, far away, he put the dynamite down in the grass. There was a slow stoop, and a long pause, and a brilliant little spark visible in the extreme distance as he lit the fuse. Then Mike began to run back to the house. He ran and ran. He kept running. He seemed to be taking forever to run, and just as he put his foot on the porch step, the dynamite exploded. There was an immense shower of plants and dirt. Uncle Mike was driven into Jumbo, and both went through the screen and the screen door. Diane was sitting on the porch swing and was propelled back over the railing and almost dumped in the forsythia. The hash pipe was pushed out of Dirty Eddie's teeth and into his face, leaving a blister on the end of his nose. Several windows were broken. Some shingles were blown off the porch roof. Uncle Mike had planted the dynamite 5 feet from the house. To flaming youth let virtue be as wax. William Shakespeare, Hamlet. 13. The Baby Boom's Garden of Eden. Thanks for the snake. Were the 60s primarily a political phenomenon? Were the 60s primarily a cultural phenomenon? Were the 60s primarily a social phenomenon? Don't ask us. In the 60s, the baby boom was the tailgate party, not the team on the field. There was a lot of talking about my generation. Pete Townsend, born 1945. But it wasn't my generation that was causing what's going on. Marvin Gaye, born 1939, during the youthquake. A coinage from Punch, edited by people born when mastodons roamed the earth. A birth year checklist tells the story. Bob Dylan, 1941. John Lennon, 1940. Mick Jagger, 1943. Timothy Leary, 1920. Ken Kesey, 1935. R. Crumb, 1943. Peter Max, 1937. Bernardine Dorn, 1942. Bill Ayers, 1944. Che Guevara, 1928. Malcolm X, 1925. Muhammad Ali, 1942. Abby Hoffman, 1936. Jane Fonda, 1937. Gloria Steinem, 1934. Jimi Hendrix, 1942. Jerry Garcia, 1942. Chairman Mao, 1893. I guess to fully understand what it was like to be young in the 1960s, you had to not be. The silent generation, as usual, was producing the loudest noise. The most influential 60s scene makers, who were actually members of the baby boom, were Donovan, 1946, and Twiggy, 1949. We aren't the generation of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, expanded consciousness, the new left, black power, or women's liberation. We're the generation of the fanboy. Jan Wenner, 1946. Grand Funk Railroad, all born in the early 1950s. And Ben and Jerry, both born in 1951. As their ice cream attests, go for the butter pecan, skip the fish food. The baby boom enjoys its luxuries. And what is more luxurious than knowing something wasn't our fault? Especially something like the 60s. It was a comic interlude in a century that needed one. Not that we didn't take being ridiculous seriously. That was part of the fun. You can goof off at work, but you can't goof off at goofing off. Fun engages your attention. The personal is the political was a fun idea. Not that we goof-offs used the phrase at the time, any more than we called ourselves hippies, Dirty Eddie accepted, or claimed that what's going on was a youth quick. The personal political slogan came a little later from the feminists, once they had realized they should be pissed off about the sexual revolution and everything else. But we got the idea. Politics was all about me. We, the me of the United States, in order to form a more perfect me, establish just me, ensure domestic tranquility, Diane had moved in with me, provide for defense of me, Uncle Mike had guns, promote going on welfare, if it came to that, for me, and secure the blessing of liberty to me, and abortion rights for my posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for me. Jim Fisk's constitutional law class had happily degenerated into an hour-long, three-times-a-week shouting match about the war in Vietnam. It is difficult, at this late date, to explain who was shouting at whom and about what. The professor opposed the war in Vietnam, and the students opposed the war in Vietnam, except for one holdout co-ed whose fiancé was a Marine lieutenant in Vietnam, and she was too cute to shout at. But in politics as in life, once things get personal, a lot of shouting ensues. The professor, who had once had something to do with Adlai Stevenson's presidential campaign, possibly involving yard signs, believed in fighting communism by diplomatic engagement, addressing the individual aspirations of indigenous Marxist political movements, playing upon the contradictions and rivalries within the Sino-Soviet bloc. "You don't understand," he would shout. "Yugoslavia is the future." The students believed the Viet Cong hated LBJ almost as much as we did. Jack Hubert said the pot in Vietnam was amazing. And the Viet Cong had that cool name, like with a fistful of Lyndon Johnson instead of Bay Ray and Huey helicopters instead of biplanes, hanging in there on top of a monument to greedy materialism. They were obviously the good guys. Or would be the good guys if they'd stop trying to kill the cute co-ed's fiancé and he'd stop trying to kill them. War being wrong. "War is wrong," a pacifist student would shout at an activist student. "Imperialism is wrong," the activist student would shout back. "Neocolonialism is wrong," a leftist student would shout at both of them. "America!" The leftist students such as Jumble were able to get the K in there verbally, "is waging war on Vietnam," pronounced Vietnam if you were against the war and Vietnam if you were for it, "to exploit Vietnamese natural resources," which nowadays would have brought the shouting to a halt while somebody Googled to see if Vietnam has any. But Larry Page and Sergey Brin hadn't invented Google yet. There are a couple of those Generation X slackers who had to come up with Google because they lacked the baby boom gumption for a real shouting match, if you ask me. And you'll note that Google never settles a baby boom shouting match anyway. It just causes a brief, smug pause. "Natural resources like rice," someone else would shout. "The company that owns Uncle Ben's rice is part of the military-industrial complex like Dow Chemical that produces saran wrap and napalm. Uncle Ben is a racist stereotype. War is wrong because saran wrap exploits black people. My fiancé is in Vietnam," Jim said. I had to raise my voice to a shout in constitutional law class to point out that the war is unconstitutional, Article 1, Section 8. When the bell rang, everyone left to smoke pot, often at the professor's house, except for the cute co-ed. She went back to her sorority, although they were starting to smoke pot there, too. Dirty Eddie founded a commune on the farm we were renting, at the other end of the hayfield from the dynamite hole. The generation that had bitterly protested even the slightest of yard work chores decided, for a moment, to go back to the land. There was only one vegetable the commune had any success growing, until they got paranoid after seeing a sheriff's department car go by the end of the farm's driveway and smoked the single plant when it was 3 inches tall. The commune members were building wigwams, teepees, yurts, and geodesic domes, although it was difficult to tell which was supposed to be what. These structures were held together with tangled skeins of cordage and big snarls of rope tied in hopeless clumps of failed half-hitches, sheet bends, and bowlines. As I mentioned earlier, the Boy Scouts had not engaged the baby boom's attention. Whenever it rained, or the wind blew, or they needed to go to the bathroom, or get a drink of water, or cook something, the commune members were, quite communistically, in our house. Jumbo said they should study Kim Il-sung's North Korean doctrine of juche, or self-reliance, and go rely on themselves in their yurts. The fact that North Korea is still around indicates that Kim Il-sung was not a fellow member of Bat Patrol Troop 44 with me and Steve Penske in the Methodist Church Gymnasium. Dirty Eddie's commune lasted a month. It was a decade without quality control, and it was not, of course, a decade. The 60s, as they are popularly remembered, what might too well be called the High 60s, was an episode of about 72 months duration that started in 1967 when the baby boom had fully infested academia and America's various little bohemian enclaves such as Greenwich Village, Haight-Ashbury, Big Sur, and the finished basement at my house, and came to an abrupt halt in 1973 when conscription ended and herpes began. Meanwhile, all dreck broke loose. There was the music. We must not be deceived into nostalgia. The word is from the Greek nostos, to come home, and algos, pain. Let us recall what a pain we were when we came home and turned up in a Gotta Da Vita by Iron Butterfly on the stereo in the finished basement. Do what you can to banish from your mind all balmy impressions of the 60s. Fill out a tax form. Have a phone chat with your insurance agent. Play Grand Theft Auto 5 with an 8-year-old nephew. Get a prostate exam. Now, listen to a Jerry Garcia guitar solo. As Al Bartz put it in 1973, what did the Grateful Dead fan say when he ran out of pot? What a shitty band. Andy Warhol was a revelation, though not his Marilyn Monroe portraits. The baby boom never understood Marilyn Monroe as a sex object, too much of an adult fantasy for a perpetually young generation. Although a few of us understood her as a role model if we wanted to dress up as somebody our mother was jealous of and die tragically, it was the Brillo and the Campbell's soup that we liked. Artistic brilliance was right there staring us in the face. Everything was artistic, and anybody could be artistically brilliant. Diane's art class started turning out paintings of Kleenex boxes, Dixie cups, Lifebuoy soap bars, Prel shampoo tubes, and Ban aerosol deodorant cans. The lettering is surprisingly hard to do in egg tempera. There was a poet in those days, Aram Saroyan, son of the novelist and playwright William Saroyan. Here is an Aram Saroyan poem. Priit. That's all. That's the whole thing. P-R-I-I-T. Aram Saroyan received a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. I was nominated for a grant myself, a fellowship to go to graduate school. A professor put me up for it, and not the one smoking pot with Jim Fisk's constitutional law class. My ambition was to write incomprehensible novels, although James Joyce seemed to have a lock on that, so maybe I'd write incomprehensible